Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo.
Morning.
Where are you this morning?
I'm at home in Burlington, but I will be leaving for sunny Dubai tomorrow evening for a coursework starting called High Impact Research, Mark. And I think you'll be participating with us as we take it around the world. But it's been really exciting, to kind of promote research, but beyond research, right? It's like, what can we do that creates an impact? I think we're trying to shift to research for the sake of doing research, which, you do it to learn. Then how do you make an impact with it? And there's a lot of curiosity around that. Not to say that I have all the answers, but we're going to share some ideas there.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm actually at home getting ready to go to the airport. Therefore, I don't have my ortho, I don't have my standard presentation background. But for you, I've got a golf shirt.
Yes.
No tie. I got criticized for being an old fogey yesterday for having a tie for the last recording. And I don't have my Ortho Joe mug, but I've got an old American Board of Orthopedic Surgery mug that
I don't want to put brands, but I have a sort of Canadian brand. Tim, but I do Horton. Keep my always close by, always. So I have it kind of double up here.
I love Tim Hortons. We were just up at Cabot. Playing a little golf in Nova Scotia, and I got my Tim Hortons fix. So
there is something. I have to imagine that it's one of the top five Canadian things. Yeah, at least, there's maple syrups up there pretty high too, and hockey's up there. But boy, Tim Hortons up there.
It's a fine outfit. Well, so what I want to talk about, Mo, is a recent article that we published on ankle fractures, which are very, very common injury. And it's really focused on the issue of gravity stress test. And it's a Norwegian group. They looked at a cohort of patients where they conducted these gravity stress tests in 149 patients with Weber B fractures, and some of them were classified as stable and some as partially unstable with basically a positive gravity stress test. Then they treated all of them with a functional boot and weight bearing, both groups, and followed them for 2 years with validated outcome scores times two and radiographs, etc. And really, what they found was that there was no difference in the functional outcome scores, no radiographic differences for these patients who half or nearly half had unstable or partially stable fractures with the gravity stress test. And obviously, I'm as guilty as anyone else of appreciating research that backs up your own biases. And I've never used gravity stress tests. I've always used early weight bearing and an orthosis with a repeat x-ray. And so I'm just wondering what you have discovered in after I alerted you that that's what I want to talk about in OE, the whole issue of stability in ankle fractures. Mm.
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing. And I actually went back and just started looking back at original sort of work. So you'll remember that OE really focuses on randomized trials. So the one thing that there's a paucity of truly is randomized clinical trials that are looking at stress testing specifically and the outcomes and then, what you do with those. What we're seeing lots of in the literature, which I went back and looked at, was just large observational data sets to say, okay, well, what's the predictive value of doing it? And, it's interesting because it takes me back a little while. I still remember sitting in the audience when Paul Turnetta and Tim McConnell presented a paper, and they had called it. I'm just going to read a couple of these things here because you'll see how it kind of evolves. Stress examination of the supination external rotation type fibular fracture. So the isolated fibular fracture that everyone thought, okay, well, you just treat that, or you can, depending on what you're going to do with it, you either operate or you won't. But for the most part, it was probably treat these patients non-operatively. Yeah. 36% of those were identified, or roughly that one in three, as having an unstable pattern based on stress testing. So this idea of stress testing, and this was published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, 2004. So it was interesting to see that, you know, there was this, it's 20 years ago that we've been talking about this at a level that, you know, starting to get that debate going. Ken Koval, Nirmal Tejwani, Ken Eagle, and the same issue of the JBJS that year also talked about, well, stress testing is one thing, right? And they had found even a bigger number, 65% of patients with isolated fractures. But they had said, if they have no clinical symptoms on the medial side, didn't matter. So they had sort of started talking about, well, we think it's, you know, if you've got pain of palpation, if you've got swelling, if you've got ecchymosis, all those sorts of things start adding up the, you know, sort of the probability that there's, you know, more significant problems. Again, this basically more alerting everyone that, you know, we should be aware of it. And maybe, you know, deltoid ligament repair should be one of the options, or what are you going to do? But I think what you're saying at the end of the day is, doesn't seem to really matter, right? I mean, you're going to keep an eye out for it, but the stress testing itself in isolation didn't matter. So numerous studies thereafter have basically hinted to the idea that if you have a stress test in isolation that's positive with no clinical symptoms, doesn't make any sense. So it really focused a lot on the clinical findings, very similar to, I think, what your approach has been, Mark, which is, you know, try them and see how they do and then keep evaluating, right? Rather than base it on an asymptomatic stress test that may or may not show more than 4 millimeters of widening of the medial clear space kind of thing. And so it's interesting, and I can go down and down and down that line, but there does seem to have been an evolution. So I don't know if you perceive this particular study as being yet another one in the, you know, in the mounting evidence that maybe the, you know, that the value of the stress test is, well, somewhat limited now.
Yeah, I think that's the position of this study in a very, I think, well done way in this type of investigation. It's definitely swung the pendulum back against trials of weight bearing for the Weber B fracture, which, you know, as I said, that's been my bias. But I sort of do like to follow the evidence, you know, like you do. So
absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And the thing is that the risk you have if you act on all these is a lot of false negative findings, like false positives, right? In the context of that, you know, if you think there's something going on when there isn't, then you know you're over-treating in some way as well. So you have to be a little careful. But I think at the end of the day, you know, managing it, being aware that it could exist, but also, you know, tracking and following for it, I think is the key. And like anything else, right? You just have to be aware of it and not be too dogmatic in the approach you use, which I think is very, very helpful. The bigger issue, though, is when do we know? I guess, you know, in this whole process, you know, it's been 20 years of looking at research in this area. When do you know that you have the answer? Like, in other words, I'm sure that right now there are going to be those listening who say, you know, no, you know, like, you know, I use it, and here's how I use it, versus those who say, you don't need to use it. It's a classic, you know, to operate or not to operate, to do this or not to do this, you know, to act on a prior likelihood. And, you know, does the stress test improve your likelihood? But it doesn't seem to be gaining momentum. It seems, if anything, it seems to be losing steam, at least in the, you know, in favor of other standard approaches.
Agree completely. But that was my next question for you, my friend, who has such a great experience with large trials. Do we need a large trial on the use of stress tests or not? What would your view be at this point?
Yeah. And so, you know, it would seem to me that, you know, and can I ask a question? How many patients were in this study? Like the one that just came out that you just talked about?
Yeah, roughly? It was just. I'm going to look at it. 149 patients. So not a big.
No, but still, I mean, it's over 100, which is great. And a lot of the studies were about 100 or so patients. You know, if you look at, but before jumping into trials, I guess, right, it's always to say, you know, what can we modify, what can't we modify? So you can actually do a stress test or you don't, right?
Right.
You can't choose whether someone has ecchymosis. You can't choose whether someone has pain to palpation. You can't choose whether they have swelling, for example. So, you know, there'd be some factors that are modifiable and some that aren't. And I guess the broader question is, So I'll go back to like the two papers that were in JBJS 20 years ago, you know, Tornetta's paper, and I hope I'm quoting it right, because if I'm not, I'm going to hear about it for sure. I know I'm going to hear it. I'm hoping I'm being right. I'm hoping Tim McConnell will apologize to my friend if I haven't quoted this right. But they had basically written and said, you know, they didn't believe that there were other factors. So they had actually said that, you know, tenderness, ecchymosis, swelling were not predictive of deltoid instability. However, in the same journal, you know, Ken Koval and Ken Eagle had written quite specifically that they did have independent association. So when there's uncertainty about what factors are even leading to outcomes, if you choose what the outcome of interest is, and, you know, and I guess that would be, you know, some period of time after you think an ankle fracture, 6 months, a year, maybe 2 years, and then look in a very large cohort, no different than what's happened with ACL, no difference what happened with hip fractures. We're still trying to do a big cohort with hip fractures, Mark, but proximal humerus fractures, just big data sets, identify all the variables and then start a very targeted approach, whether it's going to be an algorithm that you're comparing A versus B, or it will just be one specific thing. Because it may turn out that all of our focus in spending money on a stress test may be wasted because we've missed the fact that there may be two or three other really important variables that we should be spending our money on that could have really important outcomes for patients with ankle fractures. So I don't think I've answered your question, but I think I've answered your question.
Yeah, I think so. You've given a hint that a large trial would be beneficial. So I was just thinking the randomized no stress test and stress test for Weber Bees, and it would be great if we had 500-600 patients in each arm, followed for a year. This study, they followed them for 2 years, which is even better. But followed for a year would be easier. That would really be, I think, as you alluded to earlier, the answer. And then we could put that stress testing to rest. Seem reasonable?
So another way to take this as well is could be, so you do the stress test, and then the question is, what do you do with the information from that stress test? So you could say, you know, in 100 ankles, let's say you might have 36 that are stress test positive. So what do you do with that? So once you stress tested them and someone's stress positive, should you then randomize them at that point and say, okay, well, what do you do? You know, so because, you know, if you hadn't done it, you would have just treated them all non-operatively. One, you would actually have to do something for, and something then you would treat the other group non-operatively, and then the other group would be treated non-operatively. So right. It's almost like this pathway, and then it gets back to the debate of what would you do in a stress test positive ankle, right? So what would be the discussion? And, you know, having just have visited sort of the robust discussions that are happening at the American Academy of Foot and Ankle Surgery, I suspect there would be lots and lots of interesting debate about what would be the optimal management of dealing with the incompetent deltoid ligament in an ankle fracture, an otherwise isolated. So, you know, you see, the more we start talking, the more we start coming up with multiple designs. But the point of the matter is we should be having these discussions, right? I mean, it's an important topic. And if in ankles, wrists, hips, the fact that we haven't seen a massive, massive global evaluation of outcomes just in a large way collecting, because there's enough ankles alone that you could create a very large database. I know that there's been some attempt in proximal humerus in Canada. CIHR did fund a study, a few thousand patients, I think maybe it's more than that by now, but a large number of patients to try to understand prognostic factors after which you would design trials. I wonder if we should be doing the same with ankle fractures, and maybe it's being done and I'm just not aware, but that would be a very important step, I think, for us.
Couldn't agree more. And it certainly seems like the next logical step. We are always talking about how to design large, simple trials, but the word simple is just, it never is simple.
Nothing is simple. Well, and in our day and age in Canada, it's frugal too, right? I mean, unfortunately, the cost of doing research is just becoming almost prohibitive for most, you know, national organizations. So where do we do this? So either we continue to find new sources of revenue for these trials, or we find more efficient ways, you know, which is data linkages, simpler data collection. You don't, you said it from day one, I'll never forget, you know, Julie Agel, first day says, I do not want, like, every, like, what are you doing with every data point you're collecting on the sprint trial going back to 1998? Yeah. I remember that. And it was at that time, I thought, you know, why do we care? Like, this is collected what we can. But the reality was, you're absolutely right. It takes a lot of energy and time to collect information, and it's a waste of time to collect information you don't need. So I remember that very clearly.
Well, good. You've always been a thoughtful student. In addition to being a fantastic leader, Mo. Well, it sounds like we don't have the answer, but this study maybe will provoke somebody to get working on that that large cohort information step, and then design an appropriate trial afterwards. But for now, because my bias has been confirmed, I'm going to continue to not do stress tests and treat them with early weight bearing and follow them with x-rays at 2 to 3 weeks. So,
well, nothing beats follow-up. Nothing beats follow-up, Mark, right? Nothing beats follow-up, though.
So. That's exactly right. Well, it's been great chatting with you, and safe travels. I'll cross planes with you somewhere.
Oh, maybe. I hope later. Well, I just hope it's. If you're on my plane, you're in the wrong place. I'll tell you that. We've got a very awry. But anyways, yeah, safe travels.
Yeah, enjoy that Tim Hortons. I wish I had some.
All right. I've got a second one coming. Take care.
Cheers.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.